me turn it down.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. This is Carol Brouillé. This is the second hour. It's September 8th, 2008, and it's a 9/11 truth show. And I'm very, very honored and delighted to discover that we have Eric Lawyer with us. And Eric is the founder of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth and has just such an incredible story of his own personal transformation. I hope, Eric, that you'll share it with me and the listeners. Welcome to
sure.
the show.
Thank you. So, let me just go right into it.
Yeah, why don't you tell me? Okay. I read it and it's just so powerful. I want to hear you say
okay,
it.
It's just a little bit of my background is I've been a firefighter here in Seattle for a little over 12 years, and I was in Sacramento before that, and I've been a paramedic for years before that. So I've been in emergency services for about 20 years. And so when 9/11 happened, it was obviously huge for me, just like it was for everybody else. But I had gone out there mainly for to show support for the funerals and that type of, you know, for our brothers in New York. And because typically at a firefighter funeral, you have thousands of firefighters. And because of the sheer number and the number of days it was going over, they weren't able to get very many at each funeral. And so they put a call out kind of around the country to, you know, for people to come out, firefighters to come out and help. And so we did. And so it was very impactful. It was very emotional. And I was very angry, you know, with the terrorists and very just all the emotions that everybody goes through. And it wasn't, and I never really questioned the official story, and I never even thought to question it really, because it seemed so obvious. And so I did hear a lot of the people bringing up the, you know, some skepticism, and at first I thought it was just because they didn't like the president, and there's always going to be people like that, and I just dismissed them over and over. And as it got a little bit louder, I actually read Popular Mechanics debunking and all the different things like that. And as I say in the letter, you know, it's don't confuse me with the facts. I've got my mind made up, and I really didn't look at anything. And whenever anyone approached me, my own lieutenant mentioned it for years and years, and I just didn't want to listen to him. And when everyone approached me with it, I would shut down and I put up my walls and not listen. And the only way someone got to me was from the back door, really. And my good friend of mine brought up the economy and what was happening. And he's a financial advisor. He's the vice president of a big company, and kind of talked to me about that. And so I started investigating on my own what was causing that. And with all the stuff out on the internet, it just led more and more to 9/11 stuff. And so it kind of got me in looking at stuff that way. And once I started looking at the evidence with not as much emotion attached to it, because no one was shoving it down my throat, I was kind of just shocked. I was like, I didn't know this. And I started realizing all the things I didn't know. And so I started saying, well, what is the evidence? And so I went to the government websites themselves, the one with the Zacharias Moussaoui trial, and I looked at the trial exhibits, and I started realizing all the evidence they have didn't make sense to me from being a firefighter and what I've seen in fires and when things are, you know, that heavily damaged. I haven't seen things so well preserved like that. If you're ever in a fire room, you know, the room of origin especially, any firefighter knows that you don't have that kind of survival of paper and plastic and that type of stuff. Everything's, you know, destroyed if it's out in the open. So that's what really opened my eyes. And then I started looking at the laws from the fire side, and I found out, you know, that they didn't investigate for explosives. And once I started seeing that, then I started looking at more stuff. And once I saw the pattern, I went, wait a second, something's not right here. And that's when I went and actually watched Richard Gage, who's, I guess, is going to be on next. See, I went and watched him speak in Canada, and that would seal the deal for me. When you look at it from a scientific standpoint, from a fire investigation standpoint, any way you look at this, the facts don't add up. And so it left me with this overwhelming questioning, and then at the same time I thought I was crazy, and then I'm going through all the emotions with that. And so I went back and forth, like, what do I do with this information now? And the big thing for me is, if I know something's wrong, if there's a big wrong, I can't stand by and do nothing. So I felt one of the things I used to say to my lieutenant, and I told him, I feel so bad now because I get the same thing, is I said, if you're so unhappy with your country and you think they could do something like this, how can you live here? And I said, why don't you just, you know, get on a, pack your bags and get on a plane and go to someplace that you think's a lot better. And I've had several firefighters tell me that myself now. And it cracks me up because I realize how insane that thing is. When there's the possibility of such a major wrong, and everyone's response is to ignore it and then tell the people who are questioning it to leave, that's why we're in this problem right now. And so I looked at it and I went, if I'm saying that to my lieutenant, and I said, and the other thing I said to him is, well, why don't you do something about it? And so I looked at myself and I went, I can't stand here and do nothing, and now I have to do something about it, you know. And if I'm wrong, no harm, no foul, because I'm not, you know, we're trying to point out the investigation, what was not done. If we're wrong, yet it's going to hurt some feelings, and I feel really bad for anyone who doesn't believe what we do, and if it does hurt them, but there's a bigger picture here, and that's kind of, you know, it was kind of my calling to, you know, rise up and say something, and so that's where we are now. And now the big thing is just trying to, basically the website's only been up a little over a week and a half, and we're just trying to get that put together, get it protected as much as we can, because we've had a lot of hackers trying to mess with it. And then, yeah, and then we're going to have, then we're going to go out, you know, nationally and just try to recruit as many firefighters that are willing to support this. And it's really, that's really been overwhelming, the support. Actually, it's a lot more of the guys I worked with that I didn't think would believe it the way I do, really do. And I've noticed there's really, almost it's like people are ready to listen, I think. You know, it's taken the economy crashing, it's taken a lot of things to wake people up. But my own opinion is people are starting to wake up way faster than they have been. And maybe it's because I'm, you know, now in it, but it's just, I'm getting a lot better reception than I thought I would.
What do you think that people who know you, they're listening to you also because you've gone through this tremendous personal transformation, so they're that makes it easier for them to hear? I mean, you're not or are you approaching total strangers too with this, or are you just...
Oh, I'm approaching total strangers. I'm approaching everybody. It's like,
okay.
Everybody who knows me is, I'm very... Once I decide to do something, I'm very passionate about it. And so and my fiance, you know, I feel bad for her a lot, because whatever I do, I get consumed by, and it's just my nature. And not completely consumed, but it's what I focus on. So.
But has the fiance been with you throughout this transformation process?
She has, yeah.
Has she had the same sort of political awakening, or is she like, no, I don't want to?
Oh, she has. And what's really interesting is she, you know, she's more analytical than I am. I'm more, you know, once I make up my mind, I'm more passionate. She's more analytical. So it took her longer to come to the same conclusion I did. But once she did, she's on this, you know, she's on the same page with me, which definitely makes it a lot easier. But she's going the same, the emotional thing with her family. And, you know, everyone around us now is questioning us and thinking we're crazy and we're part of a cult and, you know, all kinds of things I'm hearing. And it cracks me up, because I thought the same way of anyone who was in this movement before. But, you know, so she's had that same awakening, but she vacillates still, because it's, you know, it does make you, it's hard, she's here now. She said it's hard to swallow. You know, you don't want to believe it.
Yeah. I understand. Actually, my husband is really skeptical, and in my family background, I can talk to my sister and my mom and my brother about this, but there's a lot of people who don't want to hear it, who don't want to talk about it. So I and people in the movement, some of our biggest, you know, obstacles seem to be spouses and family members, and we have more receptivity about people who we aren't living with.
Right.
I but I think too that part of it is just fear, and because it is so shattering of people's worldview. There's a woman we did a workshop on overcoming psychological barriers to 9/11, and she said, with most problems, people say, what can I do? But 9/11 is so big, people have to ask themselves, who am I? And that's much harder for people to ask, to reassess the whole world and their part in it. So
No, go ahead.
Oh, I really appreciate, your courage in transforming or going through this, and then also creating the Firefighters for 9/11 Truth and doing the outreach. Now, have you got other firefighters now? Like Richard, I know when he started Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, he was the first one, and then he got more, and he's getting more, and he still has a goal of getting more. So with firefighters, are you doing are you targeting doing outreach to?
Yeah,
we are,
and we had initially. I had obviously it's I'm here in Seattle, so it's going to start. You know, the most firefighters supporting it are going to be from Seattle, just by the nature of where it started. But when I first put it up, what's really interesting is when I first put it up, it was targeted right away. So it just made me suspicious. Like I didn't even let anybody know it was live, and already it was being criticized and attacked. And I'm like, well, how's this happening? And so but when we had the petition up initially, we had tons of firefighters sign it. So I had I think about 30 plus Seattle firefighters that had signed it, including some of my chiefs and, I mean, some big people. They didn't want to put their rank on there for obvious reasons, but they put their name and they put they were Seattle. Some didn't even put they were Seattle. So I know the names on there that are firefighters, but I'm asking everybody if they're okay putting their department name on there. And so about half of them are okay with it. Half will sign the petition. But the petition was attacked right away. So I've had to pull that down and redo it. So right now I don't have a lot of the names up there. I still have them, and I'm working on that. I'm actually going in for surgery day after tomorrow. So I've kind of had to put some things on hold. But we do have about 40 to 50 firefighters that have signed their name to it. And it's just started, like I said, it's only been a week and a half or so. So I think really quickly, the fire department is a huge brotherhood. And I've heard already, because I've been off from a work injury, that's what I'm having surgery for, I haven't seen the reactions in the stations yet. So I've heard from my buddies that are there, and it's been divisive. It's caused a lot of it's been good. People are talking about it, and I've had a lot more positive support and emails and calls from guys than negative. I've only had a couple negative, but it has raised a lot of emotions in the firehouse, and I've heard a couple guys even almost got in fights. I mean, it's that emotionally charged still, and I think in the fire service, it is more so, and then if you look at FDNY, it's even more so. I mean, those guys lost so much, and they're never going to be the same, and so there's always going to be that emotional charge, and my concern is because of the emotional charge, that's what is hard for people to look at this, to step back and really look at it. So I think with time, really quickly, we will have a lot of firefighters around the country that are supporting it. It's already been, Chicago and San Diego. I mean, we've kind of been all over the place already with guys supporting it. So, and that's without even doing any advertising. So as soon as we put the word out, I think it's going to grow quickly. I just want to be prepared before it does. So that's why I'm trying to get the website tightened up here before I put the word out.
Yeah, I do know I met a firefighter from Rhode Island when we had the conference in Arizona, the 9/11 Accountability Conference, and they had, gone to help out in New York, and he was very much a part of the 9/11 Truth Movement. So I know there already are firefighters, but you're the first one who actually, tried to organize them like they have for pilots for 9/11 Truth and veterans for 9/11 Truth, scholars for 9/11 Truth. So I really am very appreciative and glad that you're doing this. I also, especially because I think what they have experienced in New York has been so traumatizing that those firefighters probably need the most emotional and physical support. They're the ones who are suffering from the health effects. And also, I would say, too, that this really was an act of terror, maybe not by Al-Qaeda or 19 guys with box cutters or bin Laden in a cave in Afghanistan, but that because so many people were murdered, I know after the Kennedy assassination, a lot of the witnesses were killed. And right now, the most damning witness testimony is the people who were first responders and the firefighters and the policemen who were there, and they're not getting the health care that they deserve or they need. And if they die, there goes the witnesses.
Right.
So I can understand their reluctance and their fear of speaking out, too. We have a break, and we'll be back with Eric in just a few minutes.
The People Radio Network. Educational. Inspirational. Constitutional. You're listening to We the People Radio Network.
Police department officer, an ex-officer at our rally on Saturday. I was surprised that he was there, but he's working on this campaign. We'll forget the show.
Okay.
Ever since the towers fell, he drove our soldiers straight through hell and left a trail of blood and tears behind. Mr. President, you were not heaven sent, and God's not standing by your side.
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm Carol Bouyer, and I'm speaking with Eric Lawyer, who started Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. And I had on the show just before you were on, I don't know if you've listened to it or not, Mike Berger, who directed a film called Improbable Collapse.
That was one of the huge ones.
Oh, good, good. And so you did get the part, you saw the extras about the radio communications? Cause,
yes.
Yeah, that I gave that DVD and also 9/11 Press for Truth to our local fire department guys. And I have, every time I do an event, I invite the firefighters and the police officers to come for free to the events. But they usually don't come. So I don't know what you think are the best tools other besides
best tools,
speaking to people.
What's that?
Besides speaking to people directly, what are the best tools to?
Well, for firefighters and cops, it's a brotherhood, and we're together. We're a big brotherhood, but we still associate with each other. So firefighters will listen to firefighters more than they'll listen to anyone else. Cops will listen to cops more than they'll listen to anyone else. So it has to come from within. For the majority of them to even listen. And so that's one of the reasons I started this. But the best tools, just from my own personal experience, what shut me down is not hitting this thing head on, not getting emotional about it, but presenting it. And I'm putting together right now some handouts or a flyer that I'll have posted that people can just print and then take them to their local firehouses just to help with getting the word out. But honestly, the biggest thing is if you have people that are going to show up at firehouses to talk about it, is show up with ice cream or cookies, and because ice cream's always big. And I know in Seattle, in Sacramento, that's the big thing is whenever you screw up the first time, whenever you do anything the first time, you always have to buy ice cream. So if you show up with ice cream, that's a big plus. And then take in these handouts that are from written from a firefighter to another firefighter, it's going to definitely increase the likelihood they'll look into it. It's not guaranteeing they're going to believe it, but even a lot of my good friends want to believe it. But on my own crew, the entire crew basically has had this awakening now. So it's on the truck and an engine. So it's if it's presented the right way, people will listen. But that's I think the best tool is to is just be nice.
That is amazing. That's such great advice. When I started doing my activism, I started a listening project in downtown Palo Alto, and I basically asked people questions, and then I start a dialogue. But I always have information available. But my real tool has been homemade cookies and bread rolls And even my kids now are starting to take baked cookies and bring them to school to win friends and influence people.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try that. I'm going to take some of my cookies to the fire station next time when I see your handouts, and I'll take the handouts along with the cookies, and I'll try that approach. I haven't tried to directly bribe the fire department with cookies yet, but I'll try that.
It works for just about anything else, so it's going to be your best shot with this.
Okay, great. But it is also just avoiding the emotional issues and just trying to reach them on a more, well, intellectual. I know Richard, well, he'll be on in 5 minutes, but what he says to folks is just, you know, you could just give them stuff from architects and engineers and get yourself out of the way so that if they have problems with it, they can come to us.
Right.
just trying to make it easier
for
people.
We'll take the heat for you, huh? Yeah.
Right. Make it easier. And I think some other people do that, too. It's just say, can you tell me or get them to respond to questions rather than forcing your point of view on them.
Exactly. And I've been emailed already a lot of questions. So, you know, if you give them that, then they can email us for questions too. And the other big thing is, you know, that I haven't really mentioned that much, but you did, is that, you know, number of rescue workers, not just firefighters, but everybody that responded there that, you know, are sick and dying. And that's really huge. And that was an eye-opener for me once I started looking into this. I didn't realize there hasn't been that much talk about it in the firehouse. And we're such a brotherhood, and we try to take care of our own. That's the other side of my mission, is to wake up the guys in the, you know, in the country and let them know what's going on over there, because the, you know, the federal government has basically denied every request for, you know, for problems. The firefighters themselves, from what I've heard, are, you know, being covered a little bit better than a lot of the other rescue workers, but they're all still having huge problems, and they need our help. And, you know, the first step in getting help is identifying the problem. So I think, you know, that would be the other way when you get to the firehouse, is let these guys know. And I'll have a part of the flyer that I have is just identifying, you know, the facts and figures of what care they're not getting. So if, you know, that'll be another way, is to let them know that they're, even if they don't want to believe the 9/11 stuff, they need to know that their brothers, you know, are in need.
Yeah, actually there was a guy who has been winning benefits or trying to win benefits and care for the first responders. He came out to speak with a film, Dust and Deceit, which a friend of mine made. I don't know if you've seen that one, Dust and Deceit, by Penny Little.
I haven't yet.
Okay, well, that might be a good tool. But one thing is that by setting a precedent of dismissing, I think it really sets it up so that if in the event of another catastrophe or event, those who respond first are going to be the sacrificial lambs, especially if they don't get, if there's no acknowledgement about the hazards or the treatment or the health benefits that they're due. And that's precisely what happened in New York. And I think it's setting a really terrible precedent. Who's going to want to respond to a disaster if you can't trust, you know, the way the government so blatantly lied about 9/11? It could easily happen again.
Oh, definitely. That's part of the call to me, was, you know, not just it happening again, but all the freedoms too that have been lost. And that was part of my big picture. And so that's why I'm just, you know, in this real desire to wake as many people up as I can before it's too late.
Well, I also think that if we do succeed, then we can prevent the next one that they've been promising us for many years.
Exactly.
They might think, oh, we better not, because we won't be able to get away with it. I mean, I don't think they got away with this one, frankly. I think they kind of botched it.
No, there's overwhelming evidence if someone's willing to look, and that's the hard part, is they have to be willing to look before they'll see it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us this evening and for all of your work. And I will try to get word out that you want to connect with firefighters in New York and get them hooked up with you.
But
it's been a pleasure talking to you, Eric, and my deep appreciation for all you're doing.
You too. Thank you, Carol.
Bye. Bye-bye. And we'll be back in just a few minutes with Richard Gage.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Organizing Resistance, and with us now is Richard Gage, who is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and he's been on the show a couple of times before, but not since the NIST report came out. So, Richard, I'd love to hear your response to the NIST report and the incredible success that Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth has done to inspire people like Eric to come around. Want to give us an update?
You betcha. For those of your listeners who don't know, I've been an architect for 20 years, worked on numerous different types of buildings, including steel frame buildings and currently mid-rise buildings in Nevada, along with a $400 million commercial project with parking garages and malls and so forth. So I have some good experience, and I've been able to, after awakening from the shock 2 years ago of hearing about the collapses of not two but three high-rise buildings on 9/11, which came down very differently from each other. The two twin towers were very explosive events, which I'll share with you later. But this third building that you allude to, Building 7, came down in the afternoon of 9/11 in a classic manner of a classic controlled demolition into its own footprint almost at free fall speed. And we have a report from NIST that came out last week, and it attempts to explain this freefall collapse of 40,000 tons of structural steel, which, by the way, would require the failure of 400 structural steel connections per second. This is ludicrous when you really start to look at it. But here's how it's explained. We have some damage by the North Tower from the debris hitting Building 7 about a football field away, a little more than a football field. And we have some fires that are started as a result. NIST says 8 to 10 fires on various floors. And so, interestingly enough, they weren't putting out these fires. They didn't become quite apparent until the early afternoon, and the building, of course, was evacuated safely. We're told nobody died. And what NIST is all about in their recent
portrayal of the collapse of this building, or their attempt to explain it, is that we have this fire, particularly on floor 12, heating up these beams. But because these beams were longer, they expanded and pushed the girder, their supporting beam, basically, off of its seat, or pushed it and then pulled it off of its seat. Well, nobody knows that this is what happened. We don't have any of the steel left. There's no physical evidence left, save one piece of steel, which, interestingly enough, FEMA documents this piece of steel as with severe high-temperature sulfidation, intergranular melting, and rapid oxidation. And guess what? Fires don't cause these things to steal. Fires, normal office fires, which we're told this building had in it, normally get to be about, well, at the hottest, 1,200 to 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. And this melting of steel doesn't occur until about 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. This is more than twice the temperature required. And so the question, of course, is where did all this temperature come from? It's not just this piece of steel that they still have that's melted. It's that there's tons of molten metal, the firemen called it, flowing like lava down the channel rails. And even the World Trade Center structural engineer, Leslie Robertson, cites to a group of structural engineers a month after 9/11 that molten steel was still running as of 21 days after the attack. And another structural engineer, Abul Hasan Astani, cites that there was he saw melting of girders. Well, none of this evidence, which is key evidence in a crime scene, and indicative of the use of thermite-type incendiary, which can melt through steel like a hot knife through butter. None of this evidence was brought out in this recent NIST report. And that's extremely disturbing to those of us who want a thorough, unimpeachable investigation with subpoena power. We do not have that. We have not had it. And the American people deserve that. So what they do then is attempt to explain this expansion of beams causing an initial failure. So, I guess about 30 seconds as they time it prior to the overall building collapse. And the problem is that they have this very complex computer model that they attempt to start this chain reaction of events from this particular beam on the 12th floor between columns 79 and 44. And in about 2 seconds, for their timeline, this beam heats up to this incredibly hot temperature, the girder is unseated from the column, causing the floor 13 to collapse, and then there's this chain reaction of collapses. And in this computer, all of this happens very rapidly, of course, because they only have about 8 seconds for the overall building to collapse. And 8 seconds prior to the initiation of this collapse, the East Penthouse drops. So in a total of about 15 seconds, the whole building is gone. And it makes no sense whatsoever. There's no allowance for the conservation of momentum. A still body is at rest. It takes time for to generate something like, you know, an internal pancaking collapse in this case. But what I was saying about the computer model is that it clearly shows a warped, the exterior is warped, because if you did have this failure of the internal columns, it would pull the external columns inward, and you'd have this incredible warping. The building wouldn't go straight down symmetrically like we see in the video. So it's a violation right there. They can't even get their own computer model to do what the building did, given their collapse scenario with an internal initiating event under the East Penthouse. In addition, we have a set of diagrams that they show the really hot fires located at 4 and 5 o'clock in near column 79, which is the culprit initiating event. And yet, the photographic evidence shows no fires after 4. So 4 and 5 p.m., remember the building came down at 5:20, but from 4 o'clock onward, the fires have burned out under the East Penthouse on the 12th floor. So their evidence is internally inconsistent almost all the way through the report. It's really, really kind of ludicrous, actually.
So, the New York Times mentioned you as a critic, but has any of the rest of the press noticed this, or has it just been buried by all the attention thrown at the Democrats and the Republicans and their political dog and pony show?
Oh, yeah, I haven't gotten too many calls other than from Eric Lipton of the New York Times. So,
really?
Giving the power back to the people. You're listening to We the People Radio Network.
There's some distressing information, sir, which I think should be explained. Just which things have been lost and just what has been gained. Like the thousands of put options bought days before the crash. If the money were collected, it'd make quite a pretty stash. And the only stocks they bought were American and United. Deutsche Bank knows the answer, but the names have not been cited. And is it just coincidence that this firm in the private sector was once run by Fuzzy Krongard, now CIA director? And I am left to wonder, as the flames are rising higher, was this our latest hysteria, or another Reichstag fire?
Hello, welcome back to Questioning War, Organizing Resistance. I'm Carol Brier, and I'm speaking with Richard Gage. And Richard, it sounds to me like that NIST report is so incredibly flawed that their only hope of getting away with it is if people are just totally ignorant and have no knowledge and don't hear any of the arguments challenging it. And it sounds like that's why Architects and Engineers hasn't been featured on CNN and all the television networks. That, and aside from the fact that you guys need help getting through the media. I mean,
yeah,
you guys,
it's true.
You guys have the solid information. It's on the website. You have a new DVD that just got produced that's out there. And the question is just maybe our activist audience could help us reach the media. I think you have probably maybe one of the best tools, and to just let them know, hey, that NIST report that was totally bogus. Why don't you take a look at this? Why don't you have this person on the air? If we had people doing that to media people all over the place, maybe we could break through. I know it's one of those things that I've been meaning to do and wanting to do, but I've been doing everything else, so I haven't gotten to it yet. But I think it is
critical that we have help from all kinds of people all across America, raising lots of inquiries with the local media, with their congressmen, but especially with Architects and Engineers. We have now 470 Architects and Engineers who are demanding a real, unimpeachable investigation with subpoena power of Congress, and, of course, Congress may or may not be able to be trusted. So we'll go beyond Congress to an international body if necessary, and it probably is. So we need, you're absolutely right, Carol, we've got to have the help of the of your listeners contacting every architect and engineer particularly that they can find and everybody else that they know to give the website link. And the website is AE911truth.org, standing for Architects and Engineers for 911truth.org. And on there, you're right, we have the new DVD that just came out last week, has the latest evidence. It's professionally filmed in the studio, and it is really good. I've had a year to kind of put all of this together, and I feel like we've assembled it all in one place on that two-hour DVD. So I encourage people to watch it online. Actually, we haven't got it quite up online, and I think it'll take another day or two. But to purchase the DVD and these evidence cards, which we have for both Building 7 and the Twin Towers, where you can just buy 100 cards very inexpensively, something like 9 cents a piece, and hand them out to everybody and just point to these, ask them, what is this building doing? And they'll look at it and they'll say, my God, it's going straight down symmetrically into its footprint, just like a classic controlled demolition. Well, interesting you should say that. That's what we think, too. In fact, there's 470 architects who are demanding a real investigation. Would you check it out? Let me know what you think. This makes it so easy for people to spread the word without being called conspiracy theorists because, you know, you're just blaming it on us, the architects and engineers for 9/11 truth. How come there's 471 of us who are staking our reputations, our licenses on this? And by the way, it's almost every one of us, architects and engineers who look at this evidence agrees with me and ends up signing the petition. It is overwhelming the results that we get, the success rate of the people who used to believe in the official story that two planes hit these three buildings and brought them down. There's so much evidence. We haven't even touched on the massive evidence at the Twin Towers. Would you like me to?
Well, if you want to, I do know that in the early days, I was uncomfortable with the whole collapse thing because I'm really ignorant in that area, and Guerrilla News Network did their film Aftermath, Unanswered Questions from 9/11, and they couldn't find anyone articulate enough to explain it or talk about it, and I'm just so grateful that I think you give great credibility to the movement to be able to articulate and explain so succinctly the characteristics of controlled demolition as opposed to what would happen in the events of a fire. So if you want to look at the Twin Towers and go over that, go ahead.
All right. Well, I'll give it a shot because there's 15 points on our card here, and they're extremely important. We have a sudden onset of destruction at the Twin Towers, whereas, you know, fire causes gradual destruction. And what we have is the beginnings of a ring of explosions heard by 100 first responders at the onset of destruction of both of these Twin Towers, hurling 4-ton perimeter wall units 600 feet away from the building, at 55 to 70 miles instant acceleration out of the building. So how does that happen? That takes a lot of energy, a lot more, of course, than lateral energy than is inherent in a vertical gravitational collapse. Speaking of which, there's 110 floors in each of these buildings. We would be looking for those floors down at the bottom of the pile. Do we see any of them? They're each an acre in size. 110 of them, we do not see one floor at the bottom of either Twin Tower. Where did they go? All we see at the bottom is a pile, two-story, three-story pile of aluminum and cladding and structural steel and other debris. The floors themselves were pulverized. This is 90,000 tons of concrete to a fine powder, which is evident in all of the huge clouds of dust that are blown outwards from the Twin Towers. 90% of the debris is outside the footprint. That's not consistent with a vertical gravitational collapse, which is what we're told happened. We have blast waves that blow out the windows within 400 feet of each of the twin towers. There's molten metal, again, found flowing like lava underneath these buildings as well. Dr. Jones finds the evidence of thermite in this molten metal and in the dust as well. He finds these iron-rich microspheres, which were previously molten spheres, which cool in the air, and they're smaller than a human hair. They have the chemical evidence of thermite, this high-tech incendiary used to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. And how did they form? Well, under explosive event, this thermite, which whose byproduct is molten iron, actually, laced with potassium and manganese, it disperses and its surface tension forms itself into these spheres. And it's in all the dust samples that Dr. Jones and R.J. Lee and the USGS, they all find it in their sample. But the official report doesn't include it at all in the NIST report. Why? We want to know. We have an incredible pyroclastic flow from all of the heat being produced by all of this molten metal, the byproduct of thermite. This pyroclastic-like, volcano-like clouds enfolding itself due to the expansion of these very hot gases. We have squibs ejecting out of the sides of the Twin Towers, 20, 40, and even 60 stories below this canopy of destruction up above. And the whole steel skeleton is dismembered.
Well, I wish we had more time. It just went by way too fast, Richard. But I thank you so much for joining us. And I look forward to seeing you on Thursday at the Grand Lake Theater.
Yes, I'll be there. We start with a great film festival. I'm sure you mentioned it already. And several exciting speakers.
And, Richard, have you seen the latest film, too, The Elephant in the Room?
No.
It has
Are
a
we
really
off the air now?
Well, we're off. But it's they'll close down us really soon because there's the other show. But they did a great interview with